It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Tomorrow night, acclaimed comedian and winner of NBC's Last Comic Standing, Alonzo Bowden, is coming to Pittsburgh to headline at Latitude 40. Known as a thinking man's stand-up comedian, Mr. Bowden has been a regular on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, and his one-hour comedy special, Who's Paying Attention, premiered on Showtime as the second highest-rated special in the history of the network. Here's an excerpt.
Who's paying attention? That's my question. Who is paying attention? There are so many things going on in the world. You can't watch the news anymore because we as a nation have the collective attention span of a hamster on crack. I'm telling you, every day you're watching a news story and then something else happens and the first story disappears. Like it's all about the oil spill. And oh my God, the oil spill is terrible. And it's the worst thing that happened. And it's the most environmentally destructive thing in history. And what happened to Toyota? Wasn't it just like 2 weeks ago a Prius was gonna kill you? There were Toyotas doing 180 miles an hour. If you had a Toyota in the garage while you were sleeping, it would climb up the stairs and kill the children. You know how happy the chairman of Toyota was when BP started that oil leak? You know he gave the chairman of BP the biggest gift basket you have ever seen. That probably had a Camry in it.
Comedian Alonzo Bowden performing on Showtime. You may also know him from his regular appearances on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, heard Saturday and Sunday mornings at 11 on 90.5 WESA. He is on the show this weekend, by the way, and he joins us now in Studio A. Alonzo Bowden, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. How you doing?
I'm well, thank you. We live in interesting times, and there doesn't seem to be any shortage of material, does there?
No, definitely not. I love to do topical stuff, and it truly is an unending well. And what I was joking about in that clip, I mean, it still is that way, where the news cycle is so fast as to what's important, and then it goes away. And you just like, well, move on. What happened? I don't know. Move on. So, it's fun to try to figure out what people are talking about and why.
I mentioned that you have earned a reputation as a thinking man's comedian. Explain your process for developing the kind of material that you perform.
Well, it's and thank you for that. The highest compliment I ever got was Playboy magazine. One of their writers called me a spawn of Carlin.
And spawn of Carlin.
Yeah, I think there were three great comedians. Like the three best would be Cosby, Pryor, and Carlin. And you fall into one of those schools, right? So Carlin was a guy who talked topical and what was going on. And what I talk about, where it comes from, is what outrages me, what's ridiculous in the news, or where are we missing the point? Like now, the NSA scandal, right? And the NSA is listening in on your phone calls. No, they're not. You know why? Because you're boring. Because you're an average American. You have nothing to say. You know what I mean? It's like you're not Jason Bourne. No one's listening in on your personal. And then the other side of it is we have social media. Like we're begging people to listen in on, please look at my lunch. You know, look at a picture of the new car. But like we're begging people, look at me, look at me, look at me. The government's looking at you. It's an outrage. So that's where it comes from. It just and again, it's unending how much of that goes on, and I just see it, and I talk about it, and then a bunch of people laugh, and I'm like, hey, I'm on to something.
So you had an opportunity to appear on Last Comic Standing and won the competition. How did that whole thing help you bypass some of the more circuitous routes that comedians have to take to become a household name? Because you're always hearing about guys on the Borscht Belt and the Midwest Circuit and all of that.
I mean, that's what we're all looking for. I mean, I was doing the same thing. I was banging the road and you know, you do comedy any and everywhere. And when Last Comic Standing came out, it gave comics a chance to perform on primetime TV. So that's what the show was. The show was for me and a bunch of other people who did the show. It was our introduction to America because no one's putting stand-up on in prime time. I mean, we still have the late night shows and the internet now. Since Last Comic, the internet has probably become the big place where people, you know, you get a YouTube clip that goes viral and everybody sees it. But there's still nothing like network TV. You know, if I could sing, I'd be on The Voice right now, bribing Usher for a break.
You described, when we were talking before the show, you were describing the sort of the mood in the room, the little, apparently you guys were in sort of some sort of communal dressing room on
Last Comic Standing. Well, the funny thing with Last Comic Standing was if you followed us off camera, you would have thought it was 10 comics versus 10 producers, because we were always getting in fights with them, because all we wanted to do was stand up. We just wanted to get up and do what we do. And they wanted to show, I did it back when we lived together in the castle, and they wanted to show the interaction and stuff like that. And they want, you know, the drama of so many reality shows, right? So-and-so dates so-and-so, and this guy and that guy have a feud. But we're all comics on the road. So we're used to, like, they have a thing called a comedy condo, right? So you go to a club in Sheboygan, and they have a condo, and the opener, middle, and headliner stay together for that weekend. And then you go somewhere else and you do it somewhere else. So we're used to that arrangement. So we're not fighting each other. We're sitting around reading books, talking sports, sometimes talking comedy or whatever. And they're like, hey, why don't we get a feud going? We're like, stop it. No, we're not fighting each other. Me and Kathleen Madigan have no reason to argue right now.
So. See, these are conversations the NSA would never want
the
to
NSA
listen to.
The NSA wouldn't care. But we had a lot of fun doing the show. But that's whenever they, like, we're comedy purists. So whenever they would try to do something that we felt was manipulative toward the comedy, we would just really get upset with it, because we weren't like the – so many reality shows, you have the people like, I'll do anything to get on TV, because they don't really have a talent that they're selling. They're just them. We had a talent, and we just wanted to show that.
So you just didn't want to go into any contrived
– Right, ideas. Exactly. Although sometimes it did. You can't help it. I mean, it is television. You know, you learn as you go.
Comedian Alonzo Bowden is our guest here on 90.5 WESA, Essential Pittsburgh. How did you get into doing stand-up?
That's a great question. I was an aerospace mechanic, and I did that for 10 years, and then I started training new mechanics, and I liked making them laugh. Like, I always had a sense of humor. I could always joke about stuff, but I didn't know I could do it in front of people until I started teaching. And when you're standing there, especially in aerospace, where some things are so droll, I remember we had one lesson that was 8 hours on fasteners, okay? Bolts, rivets, screws, etc. Now, you couldn't get more boring than trying to explain part numbers of different fasteners. So I ended up telling a lot of jokes and being funny, and I was like, hey, I like this, you know? And I had friends living in L.A. I had friends in the entertainment business, and they were like, go for it. So
you were working for Lockheed Martin.
I worked at Lockheed, McDonnell Douglas. I've been laid off from every defense company we have. But at that time I was at McDonnell Douglas. But yeah.
Right. So you make this leap of faith into something that is somewhat
risky.
Well,
it's not a leap of faith. When you're in aerospace, you just wait till you get laid off, because you know it's coming. I did a comedy writing class. I did my first 5 minutes. And I was absolutely hooked. And I was in the process. I knew I was getting laid off. And I made a deal with myself to never work on airplanes again. I said, no, I'm just going to pursue. Because if I'd gone back to working on airplanes, I would have been making a comfortable living. And I wouldn't have devoted myself to comedy. So I said, don't look back. Just pursue comedy. And I did. And it took a few years. It took 4 years before I became a full-time comic, which was relatively quick. I was lucky. I got a big break with the Comedy Festival in Montreal, which is the biggest one in the world. It's called Just for Laughs, and I got discovered there, and that's when I went full-time, and it's been great ever since. But that's how I started, and yeah, it was definitely a leap of faith, and it was tough at times. I did some crazy jobs to pay the rent.
Like what?
The craziest one was painting addresses on curbs in front of houses. I did that.
It's amazing how an artist has to support himself.
You do what you got to do, because you want to get on stage. You want to, you know, that's – comedy is different than – I have friends who are musicians and I have friends who are actors, but comedy is the thing that you can't practice anywhere else but on stage. There's no studio. There's no acting class. That you have to be on stage in front of people. The only way you get any good is actually doing it.
And it's one thing to, you know, in your when you're working at Lockheed Martin or McDonnell Douglas, it's one thing to joke around with your coworkers. It's a lot like singing in the shower. But then when the moment of truth comes and you're taking the stage for the first time, what is that like?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Because I didn't know how to come up with topics. I didn't know what to talk about. That's why I took the writing class because, yeah, I could make fun of what was in the lesson plan, but if I had to just walk out there and be funny, I was like, what do you talk about? And then once you start doing comedy, you realize, oh, I can talk about anything as long as I can make it funny. I can talk about anything at this moment. I mean, right now my act goes anywhere from, the government, from congressional policy to hippos. They're all in my act right now. And as long as it's funny, people are like, okay, we'll go with it.
So the first time that you stepped out
there.
The first
time I went on stage, I told two jokes and I froze. My mind went completely blank. It was an open mic in a comedy club where they had the main room where they do comedy, and open mic was in the bar out front, and you'd stand on a little stage there. The stage was probably 3 feet by 3 feet. And I did two jokes, and my brain went completely blank. And I stood there for about 30 seconds, and I walked off. And then that was on a Wednesday. Then that Saturday, we had the graduation show from the comedy writing class I was in. And that one, a few hundred people showed up. There were like 15 of us in the class. Everyone brought friends, family, and stuff. And I killed. I did the 5 minutes, and the funny thing about that was when everybody laughed, like, we had never talked about that. So I'm standing up there, and everyone's laughing, and I'm like, what do I do? And it's like, shut up and let them laugh. Oh, okay. And then you just tell your jokes. And it was a great experience, but I was absolutely hooked from that time.
Who were the stand-up comedians who had the strongest influence on you?
To this day, Bill Cosby is still the greatest, in my opinion, the greatest comic who's ever. I mean, I just saw Cosby 2 weeks ago, and a bunch of us comics went to see him, and we just shake our heads like, wow, how does he do that? His storytelling, his writing is great. He was an influence. George Wallace was a great influence, and he's become a great friend, which is very
George Wallace,
cool.
The comedian.
The comedian, yeah. Robin Harris, who died tragically young before a lot of people knew who he was so quick. I always admired that. He was ready for anything. So I always thought he was great. Lewis Black, when it comes to politics, Lewis Black is an influence. Chris Rock. Yeah, Chris Rock somewhat, again, topical and strong. And, of course, George Carlin. And that was one of the great things. I did get to work with Carlin before he passed away. That was phenomenal. Carlin definitely. I mean, he had a saying. He said, he would take people across the line and make them glad they came. And I was like, yeah, that's great.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is comedian Alonzo Bowden. He's headlining tomorrow night at Latitude 40. The show gets underway at 8 o'clock. Here's an excerpt from one of his performances in Amsterdam.
I love my country, man, but we're losing it, man. Fear. Scared of everything. Scared of terrorists. Scared of gay people. Hell, scared of reading. All kind of. It's not. No, it's not good. The gay thing, man. They lose their mind. Every time gay marriage comes up, they lose their mind. New York passed a law for gay marriage. Next thing I'm reading in the newspaper, Bert and Ernie are gay. And then the other side, no, Bert and Ernie are not gay. I'm like, is that what we're down to? Gay Muppets? The United States of America, once the greatest country in the world, we're arguing over gay Muppets. At that point, the headline should say, hey, China, you take it from here. And I'm wondering, did anyone interview Bert and Ernie? Because I'm sure if you did, they'd be like, we're not real. We're Muppets.
Alonzo Bowden performing in Amsterdam. You've made an observation that Americans seem to be needlessly obsessed with things.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was an example. If you remember, the gay Muppet issue was big, and then we had Chick-fil-A, the chicken sandwiches. And I said, if you stood on the outside and looked at America and said, the United States of America is arguing about gay Muppets and whether chicken sandwiches, like the chicken sandwich king of whether gay people should be getting married, you'd be like, what? This is a country that, this World War II, didn't they save the world? Is that what we, I mean, we are obsessed with the dumbest things, you know, celebrity trials. You know, I hate knowing whether or not Lindsay Lohan is in jail. I hate that I know that, but I have to know it because it is news. Kim Kardashian is news, not celebrity gossip. It's actually covered in the news, like on CNN, as if it somehow matters in anyone's life. And that absolutely blows my mind. So, but for a comic, it's like, it's great. It gives us something to run with.
You managed to get a lot of mileage out of making jokes about Sarah Palin.
Oh, everyone did.
Well, right. But have you been able to find someone to replace her?
There hasn't been one like Sarah. There hasn't been one. And, you know, Michelle Bachmann was equally ridiculous, but Michelle Bachmann was angrier than Sarah. Sarah was – now, I don't say, like I said, and I've said this before, I don't think Sarah Palin's dumb because she was an expert at manipulating the media and creating the celebrity that she is, and she's a multimillionaire right now. So I can't say she was dumb, but willfully uninformed and saying, you know, and people wouldn't question, people wouldn't stop her. That was my thing, that no reporter would just stop her and say, you're ridiculous, you're out of your mind. You have no idea what you're talking, you know what I mean? Like, it just seemed to me, again, back in a time of Walter Cronkite, Edward R. Murrow, they wouldn't have spoken to Sarah Palin. They would have dismissed her. Like, no, we can't talk to you. We're not going to ask you about world events. You have no experience. You have not, your opinion. She just had this folksy opinion based on nothing that people bought into, partly because a big part of it was because they hated Barack Obama so much. Now, to me, the beauty of the United States of America is that we could create Sarah Palin and Barack Obama at the same time. I mean, they're only about 5 or 6 years apart, meaning they grew up in the same era in this country, and look at the two extremes, and both of them somehow considered by some people, and I'm certainly not one of them, but somehow equal, constitutional professor from Harvard and a community college dropout from Alaska are somehow both considered like, yeah, they could, either one of them could run the country. What? but we did that. But again, that's the level of diversity in America, right? That's what makes our country great and ridiculous at the same time.
As a society, I often wonder about this when it comes to people that make a living from making people laugh and making light of the state of things. As a society, we seem to be dealing, particularly here in the United States, with more and more tragedy on a regular basis. In just the last calendar year alone, we've had the movie theater shootings in Colorado, Hurricane Sandy, the Connecticut school shootings, and the Boston Marathon bombings. For a comedian who does a lot of topical humor, what challenges, if any, does that pose?
Well, I'll speak for myself. I don't make fun of the tragedy in the sense that there are victims. Like if there's a school shooting or the movie theaters. So guns are a huge problem, and I talk about guns in my act. Because, again, this is the insanity of America, that our Congress is so afraid of the NRA that they won't go after guns, which means, like, it's okay. Like, I hate this. And when I say school shootings, they're not okay. But honestly, we've accepted that. We've accepted that because we won't do anything about it. Even when there was a national outrage after the Newtown shootings, the Congress still didn't have the courage to pass even a background check. I mean, nothing. You read these stories about guns, like right now, I have a motorcycle that I want to sell, but I lost the title. I can't sell it. But if I had a assault rifle, I could sell that out of my trunk to anybody with no paperwork whatsoever. It's like we're insane. And so that's what I talk about, that there's just no common sense. Hurricane Sandy, when a devastating thing like that happens and the government does nothing and the government doesn't react for days. I mean, That was Katrina, but Hurricane Sandy, we got better, but then the big thing with Hurricane, I'm mixing up my disasters. That's how many we're having. The big thing with Sandy was they got mad at Chris Christie. They got mad at the governor of New Jersey because he asked Obama for help. So it's like, you know, it's better to let your people drown, live with no electricity, no food, whatever, than to ask the Democrat for help. You're asking that socialist Muslim in the White House to help save people? And that became an issue. And again, it's like, are we that partisan? And thank God that Chris Christie was someone who said, I'm not that partisan. I'm going for help to the federal government because, and this is the other thing, that's what they do. Like these people that we don't need a government, yes, we do. That's what they do. When something huge happens, the government helps. Does it cost money? Yes. Yes. And what's that money? It's called taxes. We pay that so we can operate as a society. Like people seem to have forgotten that, you know, like I'm not saying that we should pay 80% of our income in taxes, but there is a reason the government exists. So there's, I don't make fun of the tragedy, but generally the reaction to the tragedy, the aftermath of the tragedy, it's all kind of comical because it's so ridiculous.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest, comedian Alonzo Bowden. He's headlining tomorrow night at Latitude 40. We have a few minutes left and some different topics I wanted to hit. One of the issues that amazes people that comedians have to deal with, and we all wonder how they do it, is when hecklers spring up in the audience. Some guy that wants to talk in the middle of your act or, you know, talk back to what you're saying. How do you deal with that?
No problem at all. I warn them once that I do this every day. They're just drunk on a Friday night. I'm going to win. And it's not going to be pretty. No, it's the only creative form where that seems people think it's accepted and they think it's helping. It's really not. Most comics, we can deal with hecklers again because we do it all the time. So it's not hard for me to be funnier than drunk guy at table 42. But it gets in the way of the show. Sometimes it's fun to talk to the audience. I love doing that because you never know. You know, when you ask people where they're from or what they do for a living, so many times you get a hilarious answer or something I can make funny. But when the heckler thinks they know something that you don't or thinks they're funnier than you, we put them down pretty quick.
You've had a chance to appear in movies and to host television shows, including the Speed TV show 101 Cars You Must Drive. I happened to catch an episode that featured a Corvair, which is a car that, you know, a lot of us who remember them, they came and went pretty fast, but it's sort of been an obsession for some people that these were the cars known for having the engine in the rear of the car,
yeah,
you know, where the trunk normally is. How did the Corvair end up being chosen for this show?
Well, the show was about iconic cars throughout history, and that was one of the things that made the Corvair iconic, the fact that American car makers took what was considered a small car back then, because back then cars were huge, and put the engine in the back. Chevrolet was trying to get into the small car market and in a weird way compete with Volkswagen. I mean, the technology was similar to Volkswagen, an air-cooled engine in the back of the car, a smaller car, a more efficient car. And then the other reason it was iconic was when Ralph Nader went after it and wrote the book Unsafe at Any Speed and so on. It changed the safety regulations of American cars. I mean, back then, cars didn't have to have seat belts, you know, and all of that was changed, and you had to put seat belts in, and there was supposed to be some kind of structure around, you know, around the gas tank, or like basically if somebody hits you from the back, the engine shouldn't come into the passenger compartment.
Right.
Like, all right, that's a good idea. So that's why it was iconic. But it was a good car. I drove it, and there are a lot of people now, there are Corvair clubs, and people love them. It's hard to think back to the technology in the late 50s, which is when that car was designed. So you have to think that was 50 years ago. Technology wasn't what it is today. And safety, they didn't know. They didn't. Cars in the 60s had a steel dashboard. There was a piece of steel in front of you. So if that car hit something, your head hit solid steel. And it happened a lot before they said, we should pad this. We should probably put something soft on top of this exposed steel, you know, just again, it was what they were thinking back then.
Sure. No, but it is interesting.
But that was a fun car. It was a fun show. Got to drive some great little cars and got to drive the Edsel.
Oops. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was a big one.
Right. You're a regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, as I mentioned. What do you enjoy about being on that show?
I love that show. That show is so much fun. Peter Sagal is probably one of the smartest people I've ever met. And when he talks and brings up these topics and talks about them, and like he has writers, but his main writer is him, you know, and that there'll always be something on that show that they will ask me about that I will sit there blank and I have no idea. That's my favorite moment to the show. I have no idea what you're talking about right now. No, I can't answer that. And the panelists are great. This week I'm with Paula Poundstone and Jesse Klein. This was a show with three different comics and three completely different style of comics doing the show. I met Tom Baudet on the show. I had no idea that he wrote books. I thought he just did Motel 6 commercials. I was like, wait a minute, you do something else? So yeah, it's a fun show, and the topics are fun. I think that's what I like, that you have to be funny about something that just happened that I just heard about. I love that. It's a creative challenge that, yeah, it's great.
And it plays to your strengths.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's fun.
And you can hear Alonzo Bowden on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on Saturday and Sunday mornings at 11 on 90.5 WESA. And he is on this week. And he's in Pittsburgh headlining tomorrow night at Latitude 40. The show begins at 8. He's been our guest here in Studio A. Alonzo Bowden, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Paul. This was great. I really had fun doing this.
Likewise. Come again. Coming up, we'll talk with the author of a new book about the teenaged boys who created the Superman character in the late 30s and why they didn't share in his success. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.